Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 935. Let's just get right into the corkboard. You can send your corkboard submissions to corkboard@ID10T.com. Just like Allison, who wrote, "My brother Calvin has been working on making a thing since he was in high school. He loves RPGs, me too, but none of them had exactly what he wanted, so he decided the best way to get it was just to make it himself." Yes, that's how things get made. Think steampunk magical world set in the 18th century. This sounds amazing. So he's been developing and playtesting this game for 11 years. He finally has a Kickstarter. The game is called Age of Aether, and you can find more about it by going to kickstarter.com and searching for Age of Aether or Calvin Studzinski. This game is already fully funded, so he's just looking to get some stretch goals, which include nicer artwork, a little more flavor to the text, possibly even a hardcover book. This game really looks fantastic. I could not be more proud of my brother. Well done, Allison, and also well done to you too, Calvin. And Brian, another corkboard enthusiast, writes, "I wanted to ask the ID10T community to check out my son's podcast. Quinn and Trey are brothers, and their roommate Alex have been doing a podcast called Gazelle Hospital for almost a year now." I already love the title. "A lot of what they talk about is video games, but in reality, they just talk about whatever is on their minds. That being said, more often than not, video games are on their minds. They review the latest games and talk about gaming tips, tricks, and glitches. They have an insider view of what's coming up, but they never forget the classics and talk about all of it. Shenanigans, rants, wild tangents ensue. Gazelle Hospital is at gazellehospital.com or anywhere you can subscribe to podcasts." That name makes me so happy, like irrationally happy. Well done. Well done, Quinn and Trey and Alex. And thanks to Brian for sending that in. Again, corkboard@id10t.com. Also, I want to say that if you go to id10t.com right now, we have the official Talking Dead mugs, the ones that we have on the table for Talking Dead, the ones that we give to the guests when they come on, have now been made available for purchase at id10t.com, and I updated them for 2018. So the front is basically what it said before, AMC Talking Dead, but the back always felt empty to me, just a bare butt on the back of a mug. So we put 1855 Dead Live, like dripped in blood, on the back. And so you can see them every week on Talking Dead. That's the ones we use on the show. You can now buy the same ones by going to id10t.com. So grab those and let Talking Dead put some coffee in your mouth. All right, this episode is my buddy Eli Roth, who is an incredibly prolific writer and director who is... You know, it's amazing. Eli has accomplished so much up to this point, and he's another workhorse guy. Like, he's a guy that just, when he wants something done, he just fucking makes it. He just does it. And he is really still creating cool stuff, and he talks a lot about the podcast, about new things that he's working on, and he really, as much as he's done, I feel like now his career is really just beginning and in an interesting new way. So he's came on to talk about Death Wish with Bruce Willis. It is a remake of the Charles Bronson classic from the 70s, which disturbed the hell out of me when I was a kid, and somehow I circumvented my parents to watch. Death Wish is in theaters Friday, March 2nd. So, and Eli, you know, Eli could really just be... one of the sister wives on the podcast. There are some people who come on, you're like, yeah, you could just come every week and it would be great. So I was really glad that he came on. And I did his Shark After Dark show last year. That was really fun on right after Shark Week on Discovery last year. So that's Eli, episode 935. This episode brought to you by Beachbody On Demand, which is an online fitness streaming service that gives you unlimited access to a wide variety of very effective world-class workouts personalized to meet your needs. I am putting this on the podcast and accepted them as a sponsor because it is something that I use and have been using long before they got involved with this show. I've had an account for the past couple years. I use it when I'm on the road. There are like quick 10-minute workouts you can do. Even if you just do one little workout a day, you check that box and you're done. There's also like a range of the P90 workouts on there. There's yoga on there. There's over 600 different workouts. You can sort by workout type. You can sort by a trainer. And they even have nutritional help too. Beachbody On Demand knows that working out is just part of the equation. They provide comprehensive nutrition plans to help you meet your goals, access to information on meal prep, variety of recipes, simple but proven eating plans. It is very worth it if you just need to get something going and maybe you can't afford a trainer. This is a great way to go. It's cheaper than a gym membership. There's a lot of stuff you can do where you don't need a lot of equipment. So I highly, highly, highly recommend it. So right now, listeners can get a free trial membership when you text ID10T to 30-30-30. You're going to get full access to the entire platform for free. All the workouts and nutrition information. I use it on Apple TV. There's an app on there. There's apps on your phone. You can go to a web portal. So yeah, it is a really, really great. And I really, really, really do recommend it. Get some fitness in your life. You only got one body, folks. Also, this episode brought to you by LinkedIn. A business is only as strong as its people, and every hire matters. Do not settle for posting and hoping the right person will just fall into your lap and apply. You post to job boards. You hope you're going to find the right person to your job, but you actually check the job boards. For most people, it's pretty occasional, but LinkedIn, 70% of the United States workforce is on there. And you already know LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network. It's also a better way to find great talent. Ask any of the hundreds of thousands of businesses who have posted to LinkedIn jobs over the past year. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses rate LinkedIn jobs 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates. 22 million professionals view and apply to jobs on LinkedIn every week in every industry. So if you're not using LinkedIn for your hiring needs, you are missing out, good friend. Go to linkedin.com/ID10T to get a $50 credit toward your first job post. That's linkedin.com/ID10T for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply. Now here's the ID10T podcast number 935 with Mr. Eli Roth. Katie Roth, the Eli.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
I'm doing good, man.
Good. Good, good, good.
Thank Overall you good. Doing this. And you?
Good.
How goes the new empire? The new
country? I don't know. I just want to make stuff.
I know.
See how it goes.
How's it going?
It's good so far. It's fun, but it's... Joan and I were just having a similar conversation because he's deep in writing MST3K right now.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, so it's just all of the minutiae of like time codes and adding jokes to time codes. And for me, it's sort of the same thing where it's like, oh, it's all the, you know, when you got dreams to make stuff, you never think about, oh, there are going to be several days where I have to answer a bunch of emails about scheduling and how to get some band to agree to do a festival and route and try to help them route their... I mean, it's all just the nitty gritty that you always think about
the macro.
Boy, if this happens, this will be amazing. But it's all the, oh wow, I guess this is why everyone doesn't do this. It's hard work.
That's one thing. I heard Emily Blunt on Howard Stern talking about that. I was like, she always thought, oh, Gulliver's Travels will get me this. This will get me. And nothing ever gets you what you think you're going
to get.
But if you're so focused on what you think it should get, you miss what it actually is presenting you. And you generally get what you're sort of supposed to get.
Yeah. Well, if you're thinking about like the thing it might get you, you might like... You might mess up.
Well, that's what David Lynch taught me. He's like, if you focus so much on what's in your head, you're going to miss what's right in front of you. I'll talk all about it. I mean, on the thing, like it was Lynch.
We're rolling already. Tell
it. Oh, all right. Well, Lynch was amazing. I remember talking to him on, you know, before I made Cabin Fever, when I was working with him, we were shooting all this stuff for DavidLynch.com, and we were doing his show, Rabbits, Real Rabbits. and I asked him what's the, you know, sort of like the advice on directing. And he would say, keep your eye on the donut, not the hole. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, the donut, he goes, the only thing that matters is the information recorded on those 24 squares per second, back when we used this stuff called film. And he goes, that's the donut. All the bullshit, that's the hole. And he goes, if you're not careful, you will get sucked right into it. And every day he's like, eye on the donut. And the other thing he taught me was, you know, the happy accident. That if you're so focused on what's in your head, as you should be, you should have a very clear vision of what's in your head and what you want. But if you're too focused on it, you're missing, like, the beauty that's right in front of you. Like, there could be something really, really fantastic right under your nose. And that's actually where your scene is. And you have to be willing to just be this open book where it's not like you're indecisive. But if an opportunity presents itself... And that's like an example in Death Wish. There's a scene where Bruce, he's a surgeon and he's had this trauma happen to him, so he can't go back to being a surgeon until he visits the psychiatrist. So the psychiatrist was a woman who played Harrison Ford's wife in Air Force One. She's a terrific Canadian actress. And she's going like, you know, he's never been to a doctor. It's a psychiatrist. It's kind of opening up. And I thought, we need a follow-up scene. Like, there's got to be a scene where, you know, we've seen the sad version of him in the psychiatrist's office. But, like, we should have a scene. Like, let's just shoot another scene where we'll just give an outfit change. And it's like, after he's been killing people, she's like, whoa, you look great. Like, yeah, I feel better. And it's like, well, whatever you're doing, keep it up. It's like, and that scene, it's one of those things. The scene was right there. It was right under our noses. It was not in the script. But I was like, the context of a psychiatrist telling their patient, go out and kill. It's like, it's that really good for you. You look much better. Like, right. Keep killing bad guys. Yeah. And when she doesn't even know she's giving that advice, it's so absurd that that gets the biggest reaction out of anything in the trailer, out of anything in the screening. The psychiatrist going, well, whatever you're doing, keep it up. Like, shit. It's just one of those things that you can only, if you're so focused, okay, this is the scene we have to shoot. These are the lines. We got it. Moving on. You're like, well, wait a minute. We got like 45 minutes here. That's like, I can point the camera at Bruce and I can point the camera at her. We can do another little thing. What should we do? And I wrote it that morning and we shot it.
That's rad. That's, well, because anything you undertake is essentially, it becomes an organism. It's like becomes a living, breathing organism. And if you are flexible and look at, you know, someone said that the pouring of the water sounded amazing on these microphones. They're like, what really? Microphones are you using? What are we using, Kate? We're using Shure SMS-58s.
It's the water that sounds good.
That's technically true. But being open and flexible and not being so rigid, because when you're trying so hard to control a result that it can be too inside your own head and other people, you're not letting other people in. I think that's why stand-up is so great, because you know right away if the audience in your head was right or not. And if it's not, you adjust.
Just move on.
Yeah. And if it is, then great
Same
for you.
Same with like a scene, I'm sure, like, you know, that's, you know, from doing sketch where you have the set, you have like the people and you have everything you're going to do. But once you start doing it in the room, it's not the same. It's not as funny as it was on the page.
So right.
You're like, well, what can we do that's funny?
Well, you sit there and Quentin always says, he's like, the first cut of my movie is the last draft of my screenplay. And he's right, because you're constantly rewriting the movie, even in the editing room. And even on set, you know, you can rehearse it, you can do it, and sometimes it's just not working, or someone's, you can feel when it's off. It's like, why would I say this twice? It feels like I'm making the same point or adjusting. And I was like, I watched Death Wish 2, actually, where they say to Bronson sees a guy with a cross, he goes, first of all, the same inflection for five movies.
You believe in Jesus?
You believe in Jesus?
yes, sir.
You're going to meet him. And then, of course, that's Emil from RoboCop is the guy who he's shooting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then there's another, but then it's not even clever. The guy goes, who are you? Death. It's like, you don't even try it. Death Wish 3 is where it really goes off. I don't know if you've seen Death Wish 3 recently.
Not in like 20. My dad had the whole Death Wish series on VHS, so I've seen them all.
But that's when it started being canon. Right?
Canon
films? Which I was just telling Chris about.
Literally, it becomes a canon movie. It's in every way, shape, and form. It's the ultimate. Death Wish 3, it's because basically by Death Wish 2, his daughter is, like, the daughter's dead, the wife's dead. Pretty much anyone who's friends with Paul Kersey is going to get killed. Like, if you're friends with Charles Bronson, something terrible will happen to you. So in the opening scene, it's just like Charles Bronson on a bus. And you're like, where's he going? And then there's like an old man in an apartment. And he's like, it's like, the phone rings, and it's like Charles Bronson gets up. He's like, I'll be there. He's like, I'm at the bus station at Port Authority. I'll be at your house. And the guy's like, yes, just 1 second. Someone's at my door. And of course, he opens the door, and a gang of punks, the phone's on the table, and Bronson listens. And it's like 40, like, punks, like 1985 canon movie punks that come in. And they just terrorize. They've taken over this whole, like, tenement building. They're terrorizing the neighborhood. The last 45 minutes are Charles Bronson with like a World War II machine gun just standing there and people running into him and he's firing, they're falling off buildings, and then out of nowhere, completely unannounced, a Nazi biker gang just shows up in town and he just starts
getting off the stakes.
It's the 80s. And then he uses a rocket launcher. But there's a scene where, because it's canon, when there is Rayleigh, he's like, the couple that lives on the ground floor is an Orthodox Jewish couple, and he's like, may I come to your Shabbat dinner? So there's a scene where Charles Bronson.
A Simpsons sketch.
No, it is. It's like Charles Bronson goes to Shabbat dinner And the couple, they're like, Baruch Atah Adonai. And he looks out the window as they're like lighting the Shabbos candles. And there's like a guy, he leaves his car out in the street on purpose for people to go rob it. So he goes to Shabbat so that he can spy on his car and catch the people. And he's like, excuse me. And he goes inside, kills 10 people and goes back and like finishes the Baruch Atah. It's the craziest. But I was like, you know, people love Death Wish movies for reasons. So we got to have, the movie's not a comedy, but you got to have those moments where like the car is jacked up. And the guy's like, you're not going to kill me. He's like, no, Jack is, you know, and pulls the cord. Like, and there's, like, I don't want to give away the lines, but I was like, we need a couple of those classic Bruce Willis.
Well, yeah, of course. And especially, you know, when Death Wish came out, that was very zeitgeisty for the time because, you know, like, the American streets were, like, I think at that point they thought, well, in 20 years, it, you know, America's just going to be like
a wasteland,
yeah. Like a crime wasteland. Yeah. And then at some point, I think I heard this in Freakonomics, actually, where it reversed. Like, the trend went away from where they thought it was in the 90s, where they just thought, like, America's going to be uninhabitable. It's going to be, like, Road Warrior. But in 70s, like, the street crime, it was a...
Yeah, 1974 is when it came out.
It was a dirty time for crime.
Everywhere, yeah.
And so it's, you know, this type of movie made sense. And Charles Bronson was such a stoic badass, you know, that it...
53 years old, completely reinvents his career.
That's incredible.
Think about his career. The guy was in House of Wax once upon a time in the West. Like, the movies that this guy was in, Great Escape, like, there's so many great Bronson movies, but we all think of him as Death Wish. He was 53. It's like Liam Neeson in Taken, and he was just suddenly the weirdest looking movie star in the history of movies. Yeah. People were like, people watching, they're like, you know, like, you talk to younger people today, they're like, how was this guy, like, a movie star, but guys are like, he's Charles Bronson. He's just a badass.
Yeah. Leslie Nielsen, also a guy that way later in his career
becomes a comedy star.
Yeah, he becomes a comedy
accidentally.
Star. Yep. Yeah.
Dangerfield hits mid-50s.
Rodney.
Yeah. I mean, it's always, you know.
Danny Aiello is one of those guys, too.
When I first started, you know, when I told my parents I wanted to be a performer, my dad was like, hey, you know what? Good for you, man. If it takes a while, just remember, Buddy Ebsen didn't make it until he was 55. And I was like, that's not comforting. Because at that point, I was like,
terrible.
You know, 22. Like, I don't want to.
You're like, who's Buddy Ebsen?
Well, I knew because I watched a lot of... I was a weird kid. I watched a lot of television when I...
I did, too.
An extraordinary amount of television. But Death Wish was one of those movies that was very disturbing to me. I think I somewhat benefited from my parents' divorce, where my dad lived like a single guy.
Yeah.
So he had a bunch of VHS tapes. And, you know, if my parents had been together, they probably would have jointly said, you know, an 11-year-old should not be watching Death Wish, because it's pretty brutal. Like,
The first one is a very brutal film.
It's very hard to watch.
How about, like, the first Death Wish, there's a very brutal rape with Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum.
Right. But he's using 70s slang. Come on, mother. Where's the bread, mother? Let's go. And I'm like, is he saying mother, like 70s mother, or is he actually talking to the mother?
To the mother, yeah.
Because he sort of does both, and then it's like a crazy scene. So that was one of the things we wanted to take out of the sequel. I was like, it can be a home invasion, they can be attacked, but we don't need to be, you know, it's not going to be rapey like the
good,
first
good, 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 because yeah, it just isn't.
It isn't necessary to convey. It's not about that.
No, and ultimately, you know, especially if you... I mean, in John Wick, they were like, well, we got to kill the dog, you know, but you need some type of thing that opens the door emotionally for the audience to be like, okay, from here on out, whatever horrible thing he does to these people, I am on board with.
Yeah. And the other thing is that one thing about Bruce is he's really, really a sympathetic figure. People really relate to him. And the fun was showing a guy who's never picked up a gun before. So sort of like Bruce firing gun the first time, the slide catches on his hand. He doesn't know how to use it. He goes on YouTube. He watches a show we shot called Full Metal Tactics. My friend Sean Vance, who's in the military,
and he goes on YouTube and he goes on Netflix and watches Die Hard.
Yeah, exactly. He watches his old movies. But part of the thing is that it's the frustration of what do you do when the police are overwhelmed. It's not that the police are not incompetent. There's just more crime than they can handle. So we show a guy who's a surgeon who tries to do the right thing, who is super patient and tries to move on and tries to follow up, and there's just nothing. There's absolutely nothing. But one of the cool things because he's a trauma surgeon, he's almost like the backstop or the catcher for all the crime in the city. And we talked to surgeons, and I was like, do guns fall out? They're like, dude, all the time. They're like, people are brought in for gunshot, and they'll be kicking their legs, and a gun falls out, and it sometimes goes off in the operating room. Like, that is a very real thing that happens. So, you know, they'll check them, but they can't always obviously get everywhere. I mean, they don't necessarily check your feet or your legs or your clothes. So sometimes guns fall out in surgery all the time for these guys. Like, oh yeah, it's super common. So then he gets one that's untraceable. And we really wanted to try and show the entire process of, you know, arming yourself for home defense, but also trying to get the police. It's a guy trying to seek justice. And what do you do when you can't get it?
You know, the thing I love about your movies is how uncomfortable I feel when I watch a lot of them.
Great.
Because they, a lot of, like, Green Inferno still disturbs me.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah. It really does, in the sense that the ending is so, I feel two different emotions about the ending, where it's like, on the one hand I go, I think she did the right thing, and then in the other sense I feel like, God damn it! You know, after what happened, but I don't want to spoil anything, but people should watch Green Inferno if you want to feel a wealth of mixed emotions, because you really do a great job of just sort of presenting this thing to the audience that is like, oh my God, what would I do in that? So what do you do in that situation? And then just kind of leaving the audience with it to deal with it.
Thank you. Oh, I like that. I mean, and also we try to do that in Death Wish. Not to keep bringing it back to that, but I'm very conscious of not necessarily not taking a position, but really letting the audience decide. You know, I think that people don't like to be told what to think. And I don't like to be told what to think. I don't like to be preached to in a movie. And I think that a lot of movies do that, and to the detriment of the story. And I like it when you can be faced with a complex situation and you're really thinking, God, what would I do? And it's nothing is black or white. Everything is in the gray area, and everyone's opinion on what's the right thing to do varies. So any good horror movie puts you in the position of what would I do? How would I get out of this? How would I escape? Would you do what's necessary? And where do you draw the line of what's your own morality? And that varies for everyone. So that's what's fun, is putting people in the position of the character where they can go on that journey. And that's what happened with Hostel too. I remember, you know, someone at the ending when he runs the girls over and people were screaming for blood and cheering and going crazy when he's killing the bad guy and cutting his fingers off and slashes his throat and puts his head in a toilet. Someone came up to me after the theater and they're like, you know, your movie, the first kill, 45 minutes, you could hear a pin drop. But by the end, I was cheering for blood. And that's what scared me the most, was that you got me to a place where I was cheering for blood. Where at 45 minutes earlier, I was so repulsed by it, but I actually... You not only became the character, you also became the killer in a way. And I love movies that work on that level.
Yeah, there's a real psychological element to your... I mean, I guess you could call them thrillers, but they really are psychological horror. Lydia and I were watching the Keanu one.
Knock Knock.
Knock Knock, yes.
Yeah.
And I told you, you did At Midnight, and you were always great on At Midnight, by the way.
I loved At Midnight. I'm so sad it's gone.
I know. You were really great on it.
I realized that was a weird skill I have, is being on At Midnight.
It really was. Yeah, and that's what was sort of fun about having people on who weren't necessarily stand-up comics. It's just to see, like, oh my God, this person from a totally different discipline just thrives in this environment.
I love it.
Yeah, so you were always great on the show, but I think one of the last times you did it, I told you, like, Lydia and I were watching Knock Knock, and I had to leave the room halfway through because it's one of those psychological thrillers. I mean, I can handle all sorts of supernatural or, like, weird torture porn or, like, weird... I can handle any type of horror, but the ones that are very grounded in reality, where you go, oh, this could actually happen, and you're about to watch a guy make a bad decision that he can't take back and ruin his own life.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that are really hard for me to watch, because they're the ones that keep me up at night going, God, if he just didn't let him in, or if he just didn't, you know.
Well, it's these series of little decisions. I was reading, it was one of the Malcolm Gladwell books, where he talks about the disasters and the series of... It's not like one decision that leads to a disaster. It's like tiny little...
Might be Blink.
Things. I think it is Blink. That's exactly what it was. Where he talks about all the little series of bad decisions you make and how people rationalize and justify their own behavior in their head. It's like, well, they're cold, I'll let them in. Well, but you also... It's like your mouth and your brain can be saying no, but your feet keep saying yes and moving towards it. And it's like, well, they're never going to find out. And really, I've always been fascinated by the idea of people, like, basically you can do everything right for your entire life, and then in one night you can really destroy absolutely everything. And I think that's something that everybody feels. It's like if you go on some rant, like saying, like if you went on Live Television and you said the most like horrible things and horrible racist things, you'd be finished forever. It's like it's a crazy thing of like, that's not me, but I could actually. It's this weird fear of what if this like subconscious id, the self-sabotaging part of you, that's like, I don't want to have to deal with a fear of failure, so I'm just going to torch the whole damn thing right now. Well, so I never have to deal with embarrassment.
Yes.
Yeah. And you do it. Like, it's all slip my own throat. It's a very human thing to do.
Yes, and it's the same. I realize that it comes from the same place. In my last comedy special, I did this whole bit about how I'm terrified of heights because I have this weird thing in my head that says, what if I jump?
Right.
And I apparently that is a psychological mechanism that is, you know, essentially overprotective, but it's to protect you so that you don't jump. And exactly what you're saying of like, you know, sure, it'd be so, if your brain just misfired and you just went on Twitter and you just said a bunch of horrible things, in seconds you could undo
everything.
Everything, no matter how much good stuff you've done. It's sort of like the Milhouse thing where he's like, what about all the times I didn't wear a tutu to school? Yeah. No one ever talks about those, do they? You know, it's just seeing how easy it would be to destroy everything, destroy people who are close to you, and just making sure that you stay on the right path.
Yeah, well, I think that there is, everybody has a side of fighting that self-destructive side of, and we all do it in little ways, and we all try to control it, whether it's drinking or drugs or saying something inappropriate or blowing a meeting. It's all ways of dealing with the fear and the uncertainty of life and fear of embarrassment. And that's what you just kind of push through it and get past it. And so you're not even focused on it. You're focused on the joy of creating. But it is much easier to destroy than create. Yeah. But Knock Knock, that was the whole thing. I also love the idea in Knock Knock that it's almost like, what if those girls were what if he manifested them? What if they were never there?
Right.
Like, what if he just was like so bottled up? It's also about the way you lie in relationships to make, he's like deferential to his wife and she's just taken over the house and he's nice, but you could tell he's really unhappy. But instead of saying he's unhappy or speaking about how this woman constantly dominates him, dominates the conversation and takes the kids on Father's Day and leaves him alone, essentially like completely castrating him in a way. She doesn't want to have sex with him. There's nothing. Like, this guy is second to the kids. He's second to the house, second to the family. Instead of saying something like, I'm really unhappy. This is not okay. I need you to prioritize me. Instead of saying that, he just smiles and smiles and smiles and then goes on this crazy self-destructive.
So at the end, you should just say like, remember, communication is the key.
Yeah. Feelings are okay.
I think I might have mentioned this in another podcast, but I want to keep talking about it because it's a great book. But I just listened to an audiobook that there's a book version too, but it's called Ego is the Enemy. It's by a guy named Ryan Holiday. And Ryan was a young entrepreneur and he worked for American Apparel. But it's all of these cautionary tales about how, you know, essentially we're all in one of three states where we're either in an aspirational state where you're trying to get something going, you're in success, or you're in failure. And so it's all these cautionary tales about how ego, building on what you were saying with the Gladwell book, how ego can destroy any one of those. And if you make bad decisions, how your ego might force you to double down on bad decisions.
Yeah.
Or if you have success, how your ego might force you to destroy, you know, to just get destructive. But it's really, really, really an incredible book. And, you know, it's so easy because we all want significance and we all want to feel powerful. And ego is sort of that tempting carrot that's like, come on, just a little bit more.
That's the hardest thing to work on is ego, especially in this business, is ego death and ego destruction. And I've been reading Jordan Peterson's book, 12 Rules for Life, which is amazing. This guy, Jordan Peterson, such a smart writer from Toronto. And he's been talking about just in relationships and in life, the unspoken thing that builds up, like that quiet little thing that you sweep under the rug that's not such a big deal because we don't want to nitpick everyone all the time and go, oh, I don't like when you do that. I don't like that. But the way things build, they just build up and then it's like there's a flood and you haven't built the ark because there's like all these problems that come out of nowhere. And it's just human nature to do that, to not want confrontation, to not want to upset people. But, you know, ego, it's one of those things I've really kind of toned back on Twitter and social media is that I realize that that's sort of a weird addiction to attention. And you feel that so many people speaking out on issues that it's like, you just go, who the fuck asked you, is my first reaction. And another one is, oh, this person feels insignificant. They feel like their voice doesn't matter anymore. And I've realized that when I'm, you know, working on Death Wish, when I'm working on my new film, House of the Clock and Its Walls, when I'm like very creatively in the flow and satisfied and have a project going, I have no interest. That's how I'm expressing myself. And maybe it's an interview like this or a podcast, we talk about it. Yeah. But the idea that you have to express your opinion, Twitter is, I just read through all of those tweets now and those posts and Instagram stuff of fear of insignificance. Okay, this person is terrified of being insignificant. And ultimately, their voice only matters to them. It's like this constant carrot you're chasing that you will never have.
Yeah,
and the only thing that really, for me, it, like, what matters is what you do and giving everything you do meaning. And giving, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's a podcast, whether you're cleaning your office, just putting yourself into it is way more satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because obviously there are some issues where it's like, good, people are speaking out about this.
Yes.
Otherwise they didn't have a voice. But it gets blurred in. Like, I saw a story when I was at breakfast this morning kind of scrolling through stuff, and it was like, there's some story about how Jennifer Lawrence was at the BAFTAs and Joanna Lumley introduced her as the hottest actress in the world. And she was like, hey, let's not go crazy or something like that. Just trying to make a joke to not come out and go, yes, I am the hottest actress in the world. And somehow this sparked outrage. How rude. And there was a fucking whole article. There was like a bunch of articles about this. And, you know, it's like they had the requisite number of tweets of people expressing their... It was like,
but you also,
this is what we are occupying. Like, this is so fucking... Why are we giving this any attention?
Because it's a little less scary than anything else you can give attention to.
Fair. Touché.
Yeah.
No, I think that's exactly what it is. But I also think that in a way, everyone's going to have to grow up out of this shit if we want to deal with the real problems. Like, we can all keep feeding, you know, the Daily Mail stories, the whatever. Like, you can, the Twitter story. Like, we can all feed into that. It's very easy to. It's digestible. But it really is a distraction from doing your work, from dealing with problems, and from growing up.
Yeah.
And it's just this perpetual seventh grade that everyone is sort of validated. And also, a lot of these people, the websites feel like they're dying. They feel insignificant. They feel like they're not being heard. So they get something that people want to click on. And it's not just like, I need 5 minutes to escape my day. It's become like a 24-hour occupation.
Outrage baiting. There's a lot of outrage peddling.
And none of it's real.
And a lot, and yeah, most of it isn't. It really, some of it is, and most of it isn't. And it, and it's very difficult to discern between, you know, what we really should be giving our time to and what not. But social media is 100%, not 100, it's 75% an ego pursuit. I mean, even, you know.
Of course it is.
And as someone who is very active on social media, I am completely aware, like, yeah, I'm posting another picture of myself. Well, yeah, here's another thing I'm doing. Yeah, you know, it is all ego.
It's the booby prize. You know, like when you're at a game and like you're the loser and you get the booby prize. So you don't feel bad. That's what it is. It's not the reward. It's not the deep. I mean, when you create, I mean, look, you did a brilliant job of satirizing social media. You were able to take you could harness the energy of that and the humor of that and the absurdity of that and spin it into At Midnight. Like, you literally spun gold from this whole concept of internet nonsense. And I'm sure that doing those, like, was it 600 episodes?
600 episodes.
So those 600 episodes, like, the deep satisfaction you get of accomplishing that, it's like, it doesn't really compare to when someone likes a photo. It's like, you created something. You had an idea. You pitched it, you produced it, and you turned it into like a hell of an entertaining program with one of the greatest runs in late night television.
Oh, it's thanks,
like,
man.
But that's what it's about. And you also, we start to realize time is our most valuable commodity. It's really all we have. And what do I want to spend my time doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Those are questions that I think are important to not ask just once, but to keep asking. Keep checking in. Am I really maximizing, you know, am I really getting out of what I want to get out of? And when people say, like, they're unsatisfied or they're not getting what they want or they're not, it's like, okay, well, you know, just for a few days, just time every activity that you do. You know, do you need to spend 3 hours a day on social media? Probably not. If you just spent an hour and took those other two, you know, so it really is about choosing what's important, but also making sure that, you know, another thing this book talks about is purpose over just, you can be passionate about something, but if it's just passion and there's no greater purpose, then eventually the passion will burn out, and then what are you left with? But if you're focused on, like, what's your overall purpose? What are you trying to achieve? What's your goal? And then kind of, you know, enjoy the journey as you go along.
But the social media stuff, it is a little bit of a morphine drip between, like, it's a little bit of a tension between bigger things that you're doing. Like, I worked on a few shows for a few years straight, and then, like, after a tour where it was almost every day, I was getting attention, and then it just dropped. And then I didn't have any work lined up or anything really to do that wasn't, you know, just happening already for months. And I kind of, like, having social media there, like taking a picture and making a little video on Instagram and then getting that, those little bit of attention, those likes, it did kind of ease the pain. It kind of weaned me off that bigger project feeling that you have. That
morphine drip, you know, is a good, it
morphine,
really
but
is.
It is, but it is morphine. It is a narcotic because if you remember 10 years ago before we had this, what would you do between projects is you'd look at everything you're writing and you go, what script's next? What project's next? What should I be focused on? So now if I have the urge to go Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and, you know, like I'll have someone, if it's for the movie, I can just have someone post into my account. I went off it. If I have the urge to check, I go to my list of scripts I'm writing and I go, I'm not going to check Twitter. Let me force myself to think of a new idea, a new line of dialogue, a new plot twist. And I have just different projects that
you're
are
just channeling that energy back into your work.
I just try to take the energy and go, I want to put it, I just open up my projects and naturally my brain gets distracted. And that's the trick.
It's just, how many things are you writing? Like, what, because you seem like you always have something, several things, either at, you know, at various stages of production or, you know, so what is the scope of your world right now?
I mean, right now, you know, we're doing the Death Wish release, but I'm in post on House of the Clock and Its Walls. So I'll finish the cut of that. I show it to the studio March 13th, and then they start test audiences in April.
Is that something you wrote?
No, it was written by a guy named Eric Kripke based on it.
I know Eric.
Yeah, I'm sure you know Eric.
Oh my, I've known Eric since college.
Eric's the best.
We did a couple low budge movies together in like 1995.
Really?
1996. I've known it. Yeah, Eric created Supernatural.
Yeah, no, I know. He's amazing.
He's such a great guy. So fucking funny.
He's so funny. It was his favorite book as a kid. It's John Belair's book, and Edward Gorey.
Good for you guys.
The drawing. Oh, we love it. It's a kid's movie. It's like Gremlins, Goonies, Raiders. It's like a
makes me so
PG,
happy.
PG, Amblin movie.
No
Jack
way.
Black, Cate Blanchett, Kyle MacLachlan, Renee Goldsberry. It's so fun. So I'm doing that. Then I have The History of Horror for AMC.
I did that.
Which, thank you for doing
that,
by the way.
Oh, so much fun.
I'm so excited to have you on. It was awesome. But we've got, like, so many amazing interviews for that. I'm doing a few more. I'm going to go and interview Stephen King for that. So
fantastic.
Just like it's a really cool thing. And then I have other stuff, you know, a company I'm putting together with another producer to produce movies. But in terms of writing, I have probably 40 to 50 ideas. Some are TV, some are movies, and they're just in different stages. And I just sort of put them up on a whiteboard and it's like a race or a chart, like different stocks. And I sometimes I try not to be too strategic about, okay, this is a good movie to follow up the blah, blah, blah. I go, what do I want? Where's my brain going? Like it's in a weird way, I've trained my brain. I don't stop. There's no off switch. I don't stop writing. I can't sit down and write, but I'm always like when I'm driving, I just have, I have like 50 or 60 different voices in my head that are going and the characters are saying lines of dialogue and I don't know where it's going to go, but I can put it in this and that. Until you just kind of harness it, and then I'll just lock in and focus and finish the script and go, this is what I want to do next.
Yes, but, okay, so you figured out how to do that, but I'm sure there are a lot of people out there. You know, I think one of the biggest things that can really hamper the creative process and someone getting stuff done is essentially just their own judgment and their own mind. And, delicious.
sorry, I was refreshing. Trying to do that quieter.
No, that's fine. But it's just their own sense of judgment about their own work. So they might have 40 or 50 ideas and then go, well, I don't know which one to focus on, or these are all dumb, I don't want to do these anymore. And so, you know, how did you learn, or what advice can you give to people who just feel like they are overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that they want to do as to how to kind of break all that down into manageable chunks and focus?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is you have to kind of get over yourself. And stop being like, oh, woe is me. I have so many ideas. I can't just pick one. Because that's just really an excuse for not finishing anything. And we all do it. I do it too. Where I go, oh, this is too crazy. This is too this. This is too that. It's just fear. different. It's fear attacking you and self-doubt. And those are always there. That's just stuff you have to plow through and ignore and go, that it's not me. I'm going to operate on a higher plane. I think focusing on one idea is great until you're creatively exhausted. But that's why I have partners on projects. You know, sometimes you need someone who can really gut check. So like Roger Birnbaum was my partner on Death Wish. Great producer. We had the most amazing experience. And I want to work with him again. So I go, Roger, what do you think of these 10 ideas? And he goes, that one I get. So it doesn't mean that the other 9 or 8 are bad ideas. It just means that the 2 that he responded to are very clear, easy, clean concepts that he understands that make sense. And as I'm saying them out loud, I realized, yeah, just coming up with like, I want to do a Lethal Weapon kind of buddy cop movie. It's not enough. I don't know what the plot is. I just know that I have these characters and I know what they're saying, but I don't have the story that's enough to be like, it's not a movie yet.
Well,
it's
one guy's too old for this shit, and the other one was crazy. Really
crazy. He's like an actual Lethal Weapon.
He's like a Lethal Weapon. He can shoot someone from 1,000 yards.
It's actually more 48 hours. It's actually 48 hours of Freebie and the Bean. Like, I want to make a movie like Freebie and the Bean.
Speaking of Jeff Goldblum, wasn't he in Freebie and the Bean?
Was Goldblum in Freebie? No, I don't remember. It was James Caan and Alan Arkin.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Wait, could you look?
Richard Rush.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think Jeff Goldblum was in 10 Speed and Brown Shoe. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, he was. Yeah, that's true.
Okay. I think.
It sounds right. It sounds right. But Freebie, but something like, so, and then I say, oh, I have this other idea, and I'll tell him, and he'd be like, I want to see that right now. I can see the scene without even saying it. So without even saying it, he knows, like, okay. And I was like, all right, that's a good idea. Like some are older, and some are new, and some are ideas you've been, you know, they're like kind of an old girlfriend that you dated a while ago that you're like, oh, that was nice at the time. But now, and they're always like, oh man, I screwed that up. I shouldn't have brought up with her. Like, let's see if we can rekindle this. Like, you really think about the ideas as past relationships, but you have to have, I mean, the iPhone is great because I keep them in notes. I have a different notes file for every project because really your best ideas are when you're parking at Whole Foods and someone cuts you off and you then have 1,000 ways to kill somebody. You know, like, really?
Well,
and the dialogue that then follows is when I'm driving.
So it's about paying attention, but also realizing that sometimes it's good to keep checking in with your ideas because sometimes you're not at a place where you're ready to deal with it. And maybe a few years have to go by for you to have enough experience or wisdom or whatever it is to then go, oh, now I have the context to make this thing work. I didn't when I was younger.
I'm very lucky that I'm in the position where I can gut check my ideas with people that are professionals in the industry that will tell me the truth. And that's Tarantino, a few other people, you know, Roger. Like, they're people that I can just sit and go, okay, what do you think of this? Like, with Hostel. And Quentin's like, that's the scariest idea I've heard in 10 years. You got to finish that. You got to write that idea. And I was like, okay, if this is scaring Tarantino, I'm on to something. And I think what a lot of people do is they'll have their friend who's a great writer, and then they're sort of, you have people that don't really know what they're talking about validating each other. And it's hard. I mean, like, because the truth is, anyone can write a screenplay out of nowhere, but the best thing you want to do is get yourself to New York or Los Angeles, work with a producer, work with a writer, work with someone who is working in the industry to the point where you trust them, they trust you, and you can gut check them and say, hey, I have an idea for a screenplay. Would you be willing to read it? Or can I tell you an idea and you can tell me what you think? And then you're at least getting someone's opinion that is valid. I mean, there's also, you can't wait for someone else to validate your idea before you make it. You have to have that inner feeling of like, okay, everybody's wrong. I was like, with Cabin Fever, I was like, everybody's crazy. I am right. 6 years, everyone read it. They're like, this is the worst movie ever. The worst piece of shit. I was like, you're all fucking wrong. And then when they wanted to, they're like, do we want to remake Cabin Fever? I was like, why? And they're like, we want to use your script. I was like, do it. Because I want to be able to tell those fuckers who told me my script sucked, it was so good they made it twice. And as a weird experiment, I want to see what it looks like with another person directing my movie from the same script. So in my brain, it was just like this weird experiment. But that's a thing where you just have to be like, nope, I want to do it. I mean, there's no one going, oh, yeah, we need another cannibal movie. But I was like, we are making Green Inferno because I saw something going on with student activism and people jumping on bandwagons and hashtagging everything. I started seeing it with Occupy Wall Street when there was like a cousin who's like It's like, well, you didn't want to work. It's way easier to occupy.
Right.
Because then you're not, you can't be accused of not getting a job because you're occupying.
Right.
But really, he didn't want to get a job. Right. And then he wanted to meet girls. And they were like getting their lattes and getting their iPhones and sit around and just like, occupy. I was right. like, well, that looks like fun. Yeah. I guess if I was 22, it'd be great to rail against the system all day because then you don't have to deal with life. And I'm not saying that that was the Occupy movement. Believe me, do not misunderstand that. But I saw that behavior.
But a, you know, a yeah. percentage of people that
and I saw. I just saw the slacktivism. I saw people jumping on hashtags to make themselves look good. And really, you saw it with Kony 2012 when everyone's like, "How could you not have posted that yeah. video?" It was like, "What are you talking about?" And people in the Ugandan government's like, "Yeah, we're aware of Joseph Kony. We've been after him for years, guys." Like retweeting a video, and then that guy has a you know terrible mental breakdown, and yeah. he's like naked on the streets oh, in yeah, San Diego. Yeah, and everyone's yeah. like, "Oh, that was the guy we were." Retweeting. I mean, one has nothing to do with the other, but it just went to show. It's like a perfect example of how everybody dropped him as soon as the guy had a mental breakdown. So it's just a whole thing of getting involved in causes to look good rather than really, or and make yourself feel good out of some sort of guilt.
Without going deep and actually doing the research and doing the investigation and understanding what it is.
Mm-hmm. They don't want to change. They just want to look. They just want to look good. They want to make themselves feel better.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of people are just like jumping on a cause because they're like, "See, I'm a good person," because then they don't feel bad about the right. privilege they have in their life. It's yeah. a human thing.
And again, not everyone, but a percentage of people. And you know you. It's like,
but the other thing is that when you make these movies, especially being living in Hollywood, is you can't be the one ever, and you, nor should you, telling people what to think and what to do. All I like to do is present a situation that's somewhat complex. You know, that's why really, you know, with Death Wish, it's not taking a position pro one way or the other. It's just like laying it out there and letting the audience decide. And I think that those movies where you come out of it and you're really thinking about it, you're really discussing it, like. But the way I came out of Get Out, it suddenly gave everyone a framework to talk about race. Like, nobody could talk about race without wanting to kill each other. You said, "Let's talk about race." "Well, you're racist." But Get Out, suddenly it's like, God, when the parents said, like, "You said the Obama thing." "No, I didn't. I never." Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? It's and that's what you hope with movies in a best-case scenario, like with Death Wish, where it's a difficult subject. You know, crime in America is something. And guns, all this stuff is difficult stuff to talk about. But the movies dramatize it and give you a way to kind of live what a character might do without any real-life consequences, but also come out discussing it. So I think, you know, for writers, whatever idea they have, it's got to be something that it's got to be a twist on something we know that's never been seen before. That seems to resonate.
But I also think, yeah. You know, stuff you make is stuff that you want to talk about. It's stuff that's important to you. So I think it's important to not... You know, for creators to not chase things that they think other people want to talk about. Like, what do you want to talk about? Because once it has a real, once it has your own point of view, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, I think that's what's so wonderful about what's happening in the Marvel Universe right now is that all of these films have the real director's point of view and it's real stories that they want to tell while still being able to maintain an integrity with the universe that they're woven into. And I think that's why they're interesting. And they don't just all look like they were shot on an Instagram filter. And it's like, you know, Black Panther had Ryan's point of view. Guardians had James's point of view. Iron Thor. Man 3 had Shane Black's point of view.
Thor was Taika.
Thor was Taika. Point, yeah. So it like that's – I think that is the real artistry of being able to – have a point of view and care about something and present your ideas.
Well, that's where you have – that's the strength of Kevin Feige and my editor Fred Raskin cut Guardians.
Oh, I know Fred.
Yeah.
Fred's really sweet
Fred's
guy.
Fred's the best. So Fred cut Guardians. He's Quentin's editor. He's the best. And he, you know, Kevin Feige's in on every meeting. Like when you get notes, you're not going through a team of people. It's Kevin Feige. He is the voice. He is the one overseeing who built that label to what it is. And he's the guy that can really understand the balance of letting the filmmakers have their voice. And making sure that their voice is there, but also making sure it's a Marvel movie in the best possible way. And he's not afraid to change up the record and evolve the brand. And I think that that's what you're seeing now when you see Black Panther and it just like and Thor the way it didn't feel in Guardians. They don't feel like other. They are Marvel movies now, but in retrospect, but they didn't at the as you're watching them going, whoa, this doesn't feel like a Marvel.
I mean, how often does the third in a series ostensibly become like the best movie in the series, where it's like, you know, they all matured. They didn't, there wasn't diminishing returns.
No, they weren't just saying, well, that gag, well, most studios go, okay, this gag worked, let's milk the hell
Death
out of it.
Death Wish 3.
Death Wish 3.
Oh, people like seeing him just shoot the shit out of people. Let's give him bigger guns and, you know, throw in a Nazi biker gang.
Yeah. So, but that's what's great about it is that they're not doing that in the third one. They're really letting... And look, I had Ludwig Göransson, who did the music in Death Wish, is the same composer who did Black Panther. He does all of Ryan Coogler's movies. It's really, really fantastic. So I loved it, just listening to the score. But, you know, you see those people are really... Like, what Marvel's doing is really incredible. And that's why people trust the brand.
Would you want to make, like, a $250 million movie? Or is it just too much responsibility? Do you kind of... like the lane that you're in because you have the right balance and you have the right freedom and the right, just, you know, enough money to do what you want?
Honestly, I've been offered those movies before and they come with their own set of problems and you have to love the subject matter and kind of have the weight to, you know how to navigate it and have the weight to get what you want. But absolutely. I think for sure now I would. I mean, I think earlier, like right after Hostel, I was offered this big movies and I just didn't want to deal with it. I was like, I'm going to do my own thing. Why would I work this hard to get my own voice to not use it? But then after a while of making movies where you're literally scraping together all of your resources and doing, you know, begging and borrowing everything to keep your budgets low, it's like, no, I actually enjoy making a movie with resources. And when I see Death Wish and certainly the new one with The House of the Clock in its walls, I was like, oh yeah, this is what I can do. These are the stories I like. If you want to be Terry Gilliam, Tim Burton, if you want to make Chris Columbus, if you want to make those kinds of movies, which I do, then you're going to need more money to do it. So I think for me, it all depends on project to project. But, you know, if it's got to be, I'd have to want to make that movie so bad you just love the world and you're living it and breathing it.
Right. Any good that you can tell, any good Bruce Willis stories that you can tell?
I mean, there are many, many, many Bruce Willis stories. God, let me think of a great Willis. I mean, look, Bruce, the first scene we had to do with him shooting the carjacking, where he's wandering out, he's got a gun, he's been studying YouTube. And of course, the fun is every single time he does a, you know, he rescues, so he learns something, but he's completely bad. He's terrible. He's a terrible vigilante at first. When he shot the first carjacking, I remember the first take, he came out and he was just like, and he looked so cool doing it. Everyone's like, wow, that was amazing. I was like, Bruce, we got to do it again. Except he's like, why? I nailed it. I was like, I know, but like, we forgot. Like, we all got so caught up in Bruce Willis shooting somebody that we actually forgot that this is about a guy who's never shot a gun before. And it catches his hand and he's freaked out. And he's like, all right. So it was like several takes. I was like, wow. Bruce, you're still too cool. Well, dorky dad. And he did. He got it. He actually really got there, but it was just funny shooting those scenes with him.
There just aren't that many people left who, I mean, he's such a collectible item in the sense that it's like, you know, his career started in the, like, he's been through a couple iterations.
How many decades? It's like literally like him, Keanu, Tom Cruise. There are very few actors that were famous in the 80s that are still famous today.
Yeah. And still able to do the same kinds of movies that they, well, Keanu became an action star, but Tom Cruise and him, I mean, that's gotta be a difficult role to maintain, you know, decade after decade.
Yeah, I mean, the thing he said that he wanted to do, he's like, I do not want to be John McClane. And like the first day, you know, we're shooting a scene where he's at a soccer game and there's like a belligerent dad who's like screaming in his kid, like, what the fuck, Brit? And all the parents are like, whoa, take it easy. So Bruce, who's a doctor, has to be like, you know, dude, buddy, take it. And the guy shoves him. And he's just like, whoa, I'm sorry. Oh, wow. And like all the kids playing are like, what the... And I remember the first take, it was like one of the first days of shooting. And, you know, we discussed, and the actor was there. He's like, is it okay if I... And he freaking shoved him. And Bruce was like, it was like, there was a weird whoa moment that we were like, is Bruce going to deck the guy? And Bruce couldn't have been sweeter about it. But it was an adjustment for him to play the emasculated dad. But he's got to be like, it's like, bottle it up. Yeah. Don't worry. I'm not going to, this isn't worth it. I'm not going to set an example for my children.
He's played vulnerable really well before. Really like well. With the Sixth Sense and Unbreakable even, who was like a super strong guy, but very,
no,
very
we talked broken. About that. We really wanted to get back to Unbreakable, Sixth Sense, who becomes Die Hard and Fifth Element. He's great stories from all those days and Moonlighting and when he was shooting Die Hard. I was like, you know, it was third movie or something. It was crazy how young that guy was and what that movie was.
Oh, yeah, because I remember like right around the time he did Die Hard, he was doing like...
Blind Date or something.
He did Blind Date, which is I remember being a really fun movie.
Blind Date, too.
Kim Basinger and John Larroquette.
Yeah.
Like, that was a really fun movie. But and I think it did well, but to jump from... That was not that common in the 80s to jump from television to becoming a massive...
That was a huge deal.
Yeah.
The only, and I remember... because
Eddie Murphy might have been... There was like only a handful of people who were able to do
it. The people that like truly started on TV, like George Clooney was the other one from ER. But even that was the 90s. When George Clooney went from being Dr. Ross to Dusk Till Dawn, it was like 95 or 96.
Yeah.
Like, and 97, The Peacemaker, it's like, whoa, isn't he a TV star? That was the myth, was that if you were a TV star, people got you for free, so they wouldn't want to pay for the movies. And they tried. There was a period where like every single one of the Friends, they're like, the pallbearer is out.
Right,
like,
yeah, Paul Bear.
Every single one of them, Ed, like all of
them. Yeah, but the chimp plays baseball, do you understand?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But like one of those movies, what's the movie with the... I just completely blanked.
Romy and Michelle's.
Yeah, Romy and Michelle's.
Yeah, Kudrow, everybody. Yeah. And really, they're like, still Jennifer Aniston was the only one that broke out. And people still call her Rachel.
But Lisa Kudrow picked a bunch of really cool movies. Like, she didn't pick the... I want to be a megastar role.
Yeah.
She picked a lot of really cool...
Aniston did, too. She dove into, like, indies. She has, like, a ton of indies.
Aniston has an amazing career. But it's really... It's one of those things where you're so... It was hard, but yeah, but Bruce Willis going from... I mean, everyone... But he was also, like, the first bald guy that girls liked. I remember, like, my friend's dads being like, oh, the guy with the thinning hair, you like Bruce Willis? Like, and then he shaved his head and fits... People love him. And his music, like, he's a very soulful guy.
The Return of Bruno.
Yeah.
Oh, what was the Shyamalan movie with the one that just came out?
Split.
The ending.
It's the best.
I mean, cameo.
So good.
Is that universe expanding? Do you have any ideas about that universe expanding?
Well, if you look at the three movies
together,
it'll be Unbreakable Split Glass.
Yes, but...
Oh, how about that? One, two, three.
Are they making Glass?
They shot it already.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They just shot it. He literally shot it. That's why we were going to release the movie in Thanksgiving, but I was shooting and Bruce was shooting, so we pushed it to March because neither of us were available.
So
he was shooting Glass.
Very happy to hear
that. M. Night's cutting it right now. Unbreakable Splits Glass.
Oh, how cool, that's fantastic.
Right?
That makes me happy.
That's how good that guy is.
How
good he is. Yeah. We didn't even see that.
Even if people are like, well, the movie was okay, but the titles.
Yeah, guys. Split was so good. I'm amazed that James McAvoy is not in the Oscar conversation or Anya Taylor-Joy.
Like, he just needs to land the right role. Yeah. He just needs to land the right role. I mean, like, he just needs to...
But, like, how could he not be nominated for Split? Like,
because...
was there better acting by anyone than James McAvoy in Split?
Because it's so rare that, like, horror, which, you know, thriller horror type, which I guess it would be in that category. I mean, Get Out is extraordinary and pioneering for a lot of reasons, but I think also, you know, another reason being that... A thriller horror movie could be nominated for... Because I think they just...
Silence of the Lambs, The Exorcist, those are the last ones. Yep. It's very hard.
Yeah.
Sixth Sense.
And some of them, if they're marketed, if it seems like, oh, that's kind of a horror movie, then immediately they get snobby about it. But it's still real. You know, if you're a horror fan, you know that one out of like 10 or 15 horror movies you watch is going to be good. And it's really hard to make
a great one that hasn't been done. It's such a clean concept that's so well executed right to the end. I mean, when was the last time I saw a movie like that? Autopsy Jane Doe.
That movie was great too.
Raw. Did you see Raw?
Raw was great.
What was
the one that I recommended to you? The Spanish movie about
The Corpse of Anna Fritz.
The Corpse of Anna Fritz is
I need to see it.
Oh, that's great.
Okay.
Really fucked up.
All right, I'm going to watch
really,
it.
Really, really fucked up.
Watched The Ritual last night.
Watched The Ritual too. Yeah. The Ritual did a pretty good job. I mean, I thought it was. I loved the creature.
Yeah,
and it was great.
Wait, The Ritual, the 1983?
No, Netflix. It's brand new,
British movie. So the guy he did some other stuff.
The Initiation. That's what it was. I just watched it on Blu-ray. It's weird. This horror movie starring Daphne Zuniga, where it's Initiation. It's like a classic sorority.
Slasher film
from 1984. I noticed that the ending credits is the love theme from Cinema Paradiso, but Marconi did not score this movie. I was watching the movie. I was like, why do I know this song? I was like, oh my God, this is the same music from Cinema Paradiso. I feel like Morricone must have seen The Initiation because the music's identical.
Or maybe he did The Initiation under a pseudonym.
Under a different name. I don't know. It was two guys that did it. That's possible, though.
If Initiation. I put the two names, nobody will know.
Nobody will know. It's me. But
nobody will know. It's Morricone.
By the way, those guys used to rip themselves off all the time. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Star Crash.
Yes, from 1980. That was in the season of Mr. John, Science Theater.
Star Crash, starring Stellan Skarsgård. It was a Star Wars ripoff directed by Luigi Cozzi, who is Argento's first AD. He did some terrific horror films, one called The Killer Must Kill Again, a few other movies. Luigi Cozzi made a movie where there was like a trio of movies starring Joe Spinell and Caroline Munro from The Golden Voyage of Sinbad. The last horror movie was the other one, and Maniac were the three, and Star Crash. So Joe Spinell and David Hasselhoff's in it.
It's his first movie.
David Hasselhoff's first movie. The score is by John Barry, who did the James Bond movie, who 5 years later won the Oscar for Best Soundtrack for Out of Africa for the same score of Star Crash.
Yeah. Also,
well, and there's robbed by the Academy for Star Crash.
Robbed by the Academy. He's like,
I'll show you.
I'm going to show you. You take the same music on Star Crash and put it on Out of Africa. Rob Redford, and they give you the little gold statue. Yeah.
Marjo Gortner is in that movie.
It's true. Marjo Gortner is in that movie.
Yeah, good documentary about him.
Great, yeah.
You know Marjo Gortner?
Exorcism was very inspired by Marjo.
I love that movie.
Because Marjo was like the kid. Yeah. The documentary, Marjo was like the kid preacher who went out there and like preached. He was like a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah, at eight, he had the Bible memorized. And his name is Marjo because of Mary and Joseph.
Yeah. Oh. And so they did a documentary, and he would just scam people for money and then stopped and became an actor.
Yeah. and starting Star Crash.
And Star Crash.
And Christopher Plummer shows up in Star Crash.
Christopher Plummer is, I know. And if you find out some stories of anyone in the Star Crash that they might just read digitally, add Christopher Plummer over everybody in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the new trend.
But I looked up an interview where it's like, we got sent Star Crash. I'd only heard of it by name, so we started watching it to write riffs. And then I was like, what is he doing in this movie? And I looked up an interview, and some guy's like, I have to ask you about the movie Star Crash. And he rolls his eyes and says, a lot of British actors have this thing where they say, I'll even do porn if it sends me to Italy for free.
And that's really funny.
That's why he went there.
That's fantastic. He probably just figured, like, oh, who's going to see this?
Yeah, exactly.
Cut to.
Home video.
Yeah.
Everyone sees everything.
What if his performance in All the Money in the World is identical to his performance in Star Crash, and he wins for All the Money in the World? It'd be the second movie where something from Star Crash has been recycled.
What if Star Crash was ultimately, like, just this nexus point of all these things. Like, if you really track everything back, you would
love Star Crash.
Cut to Eli's bedroom, and it's just all these.
It is the $200,000 Italian Star Wars ripoff.
Yeah, it's like they saw a lobby card of Star Wars and then made a movie off of that.
It's impressive.
Well, we were talking about the Asylum films before you got here, because I know those Asylum guys, and they're really great. And they just sort of, you know, for the international film market, they just make, like, Transmorphers. And you get like a robot car, on a box, and then internationally people are like, "Oh, I guess this is."
And that was the Golden
Globe. It's me, Morricone. Yeah. I like a robot.
Have you ever seen Alien 2 on Earth?
No.
Alien 2 on Earth is amazing. It's an incredible film. The soundtrack is one of the best things about it. That's like for like super nerds on it. The Maurizio Guido De Angelis did a lot of Italian giallo films, did a really spectacular score. Basically, Alien comes out and is a huge hit in Italy. So some guy's like, let's just make Alien 2 without any connection. We'll just call it Alien 2, on Earth, sulla Terra. So Alien 2, directed by Ciro Appolito, I believe is the director's name, they take NASA footage, and they're like, the comet's coming closer to Earth, but it's the grainiest, shittiest NASA footage. And then it's like a guy in a Jeep Wagoneer in 1980 shot in the car, because obviously they didn't have permits. So you're like handheld filming out of a car driving around. And these friends, it's like kind of like The Descent. They're like, let's go caving. But you see this thing like crash, and a girl on the beach sees a thing that looks like a pizza with a little bladder pump in it. It jumps on the girl's face, and then they go... And there are these, like, aliens that are popping out of eggs that are in this cave. And then the girl comes out, and, like, the whole world has been taken
over. We need to be taking
aliens.
Show notes for this. So, Katie, because we got to let
it's
people
on YouTube.
Know.
Look up
Star Crash, Alien 2, Life on Earth.
Oh, it's just they could watch not Star Crash.
Life on Earth.
On Earth. But, and by the way, they were sued in a heartbeat by Fox, and the movie was pulled from theaters.
But it's on YouTube.
Shockingly, it's on YouTube.
Nice try.
If people want to see Star Crash with expert comedic commentary, go to Netflix.
But that's not
on?
That's not a,
what?
It's on Netflix with your...
We did it in last season of Mr. Science Theater.
I love it.
So you should watch it both ways. We can watch it both ways. You know, I'm going to watch the Mystery Science Theater version.
Thank you.
Because I want to watch
it. By the way, I love that Mystery Science Theater was what sort of busted the island on Clonus, the clone horror.
Yeah.
The Clonus. I recently watched that movie. I'd never seen it before. It was fantastic. What a great little low-budget thriller that was completely remade as The Island without giving it credit.
Yeah, you know what's so weird? When people bring up Scream, they never bring up Evil Laugh, which is like almost like it has so many of the similar elements of Scream, where there's even down to a guy. It's like a bunch of kids, and there's even a guy that's obsessed with like Fangoria magazine.
Really?
And Evil Laugh. He's like, and this is how it happens in a horror movie. It's there's a lot of similar beats in Evil Laugh.
It's interesting. I haven't seen Evil Laugh. I gotta find it.
Yeah.
Well, there's an Evil Laugh in Star Crash, which all
it all comes back
to Luigi Cozzi. Yeah.
Are you doing Shark After Dark this year again?
No, they're not doing it.
What?
Oh. They're not Shark After Darking. It's done.
That was fun.
That was great.
I love Shark After Dark. It was so fun having you on. I mean, going diving with sharks is the greatest thrill of my life.
Well, you got to do it.
I want to go back again. I'm going to dive more. I'm like addicted to it. I think that sharks are the most incredible, misunderstood.
When's the Eli Roth shark movie?
I would love to do a shark movie. I was going to do a shark movie and then was unceremoniously removed, shall we say, from it. But I got two other movies instead, so it all worked out. But yeah, no, I'd love to do a shark movie. But I would want the shark to be the good guy. Yeah. That's part of the problem. Not like Incredible Mr. Limpet, where it helps people stop the war. Although I do have a Mr. Limpet idea. I really want to. I have this terrible movie idea disease itis that like. And sometimes people are like, "What's your next movie?" And I'll like tell them with a very straight face. I really want to make like a total rip off of the Incredible Mr. Limpet movie called Fish Out of Walter. Guy named Walter. It's like I have two movies that I really want to do. I want to do Fish Out of Walter, where Walter's like one day he falls in the ocean, like he becomes a fish, and they're like, "Where's Walter?" But he, of course, stops. You know, he saves the world.
If you want it to be really bad, you have to, his name has to be Walter Fish.
Oh yeah, Walter Fish would be good. Yeah, Walter Fish with P-H-I-S-C.
Yeah, exactly.
Fish, get in here. This report's like,
"No, I hate the land."
Sorry, Mr. Winkleberry. You know,
staring I'll get at the ocean
yeah.
longingly.
Like, Walter! And then he gets thrown in. Let's throw him in the tank. No, I can't swim! Magic Fish out of Walter.
And then he
It's like another one I want to do is like about a nun that gets like struck by lightning and becomes a super genius and call it Nun the Wiser. I'm like desperate to do None the Wiser. I just have like these ideas for terrible movies that I really. I told you I want to do NASCAR Dog. They're like, "Who's driving the car?" And like the dog is driving with its head out the window.
Listen,
200 miles an hour.
Okay, even if you have.
If I do fake trailers,
yes, that's what you need to do.
I
have a bunch. Let me see what other ideas I have. I have some like legitimately. I have ideas that are so shamefully bad that I'm so I just get so tempted to tell people that's exactly like.
Can I pitch a show for you?
Please.
And this is a show that I want to be on with you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you and I talking about these really great movies that we're excited are coming. It's like a coming attractions, but it's just right. All of these fake trailers. But then we talk very seriously about like, you know.
No, I really wanted like the movie I just directed with Tim Allen, where he, to prove himself as a responsible boss.
Oh, sure.
To prove himself as a responsible dad, he gets a Girl Scout troop.
Of course.
And it's called Smart Cookies. But he teaches them very practical things, like how to argue down your credit card charges and how to smoke and how to drink and how to, like, scam people. Like, he's really just, like, how to drive. It's just Smart Cookies. Smart Cookies. But then they get a bear. And the girls find a bear, and the bear's in his apartment. And then they have, like, and then he has a maid that teaches them how to dance. And there's just, like, a whole bunch of things that happen.
I mean, it's already Smart mostly cookies. Done.
And the whole trailer's kaiju. I said shotgun! And it's, like, Tim Allen with a bear, and the kids driving the car, and the raft, and, like, whoa! And then going over the waterfall, and then they, you know... Parachutes. Mm-hmm.
I'm still looking for funding for my show, Anim Animal Man, which is a guy is driving down a haunted road, and then he accidentally hits a gypsy woman crossing the street who, before dying, curses him. But at the same time, the haunted urn that's in his back seat falls over while he's locking eyes with a goat while a comet goes over the sky. And so now he becomes a guy that can turn into another guy that can turn into animals that can turn into other animals. It's Anim Animal Man.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's a great idea.
And it's like the process, which is very painful for him to turn, it takes like about like a half an hour. the whole process of turning.
It's you got to, like, if you want to go out at midnight, you got to start like 11:15. You got to start winding down. Change 11:25. Yeah. You got to soundproof. You got, like, by 11:30, you're transforming.
Yeah, it's like, if someone needs my help.
I don't know if I want to help them that badly.
Finally,
yeah. I don't want to help them because this is so painful.
Well, I'm really excited about this. I'm excited about this movie about a bar where people show up and then they get drugged and basically part of their limbs get amputated and then served to a food truck, a hipster food truck that runs around the back. It's called Club Foot.
That's a good one.
If you want to see a good movie, that's a good movie. You guys should see.
I'm good.
Okay, all right.
That's a great idea.
After Animal Man, you're good.
Animal Man is the only movie that will ever be made.
But you have to say it really fast, like
Animal Man.
We can have Fish Out of Walter have a crossover with Animal Man. They team up on land and sea.
Oh yeah, you're building out the universe.
You gotta build out the Animaniverse or what? the Walterverse or whatever verse we want to call it. The whole universe, they collide, and then they have to, you know, win the NASCAR with the help of.
There's no reason you couldn't do it. You know, like the Warrens, the whole universe of building out the Annabelle, like
everything's a universe now.
Yeah, what's great about that is that they didn't ahead of time go, we're gonna make a universe. They just sort of, you know, organically, hey, people like these movies, let's connect them all together.
They showed up here too.
I mean, why not?
Yeah.
They have the Warrens have a whole closet full of cursed items.
They have exactly. It's a whole universe. And they're very smart to get the Warren files.
So maybe this is just, you know, this is just like your, this is your, it's your coming attractions, and this is your screening room, and we just shoot all these trailers.
I would love to do it. I was going to do a movie called Trailer Trash. Whole thing, it was like all these just terrible, terrible movies. I still want to make them, though. That's the problem is, like, you know, that'd be like the joke is that we're, my friend Noah and I would be in a meeting. And we'd be pitching something. The pitch, we'd be bombing. It's obvious they're not interested. We're like, we have this other idea. He's like, don't do it. We would just be like, like, Jack Hatcher was having a bad day. And his name is Hatcher, so everyone calls him Hatch. Hey, Hatch, get some responsibility. And it's just, you know, he gets the Girl Scout troop.
You know, terrible. This would be
the worst movie ever.
Netflix would never do it, but it'd be really fun. It's like when you hover over a title on Netflix and it plays the trailer and the thing.
Yeah.
It'd be fun if we could just, like, fuck with people and just make trailers.
For movies that don't exist.
And then you go, when it goes to play, you're just like, suck it! It's just us.
Why would
you
watch this?
Yeah, and then people are like, oh, I got trailer trashed.
That's a great thing to do. It's really to earn the trust of the viewers. Yeah. Netflix stock will skyrocket.
Well, the trailer
is tricking people into thinking it's an actual movie.
Yeah, I mean, I remember loving the trailers in Grindhouse. All the trailers, like
Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
That was so much fun.
Like, they were great, and like I wanted to see. I just wanted the whole movie to be that.
I do. I had another one I was going to do called The Dummy. The Dummy. You can run. You can hide, but you'll never outsmart. The Dummy. And literally, it's just like
that's 70s voiceover.
Yeah, the 70s voiceover. It's just like someone's driving, and it's just like the dummy. They're like, the dummy! And then the car crashes. Or they're like in the shower, and every time they see it, they yell, the dummy!
Yeah.
And it's just like, it starts with the GIF showing up like, huh, who sent you? Yeah. It's like, put that thing away. It's like, what are you talking? It's a dummy. It can't hear you. No, it's listening to us right now. And he starts hitting it. It's like, don't hit it! Don't hit it! It's like, it's a dummy! You stupid dummy! And then, the dummy! And just like,
but you never actually see what the dummy is doing.
Dummy doesn't do anything. Someone will be in the shower and they open the curtain, the dummy's in, they go, the dummy! And then they fall out the window and they like are naked and they land on the electrical wires, the telephone wires.
Yeah, it's just an accident.
Dummy doesn't do anything.
Right,
it's just like you're driving. It's like Paul Giamatti's driving. He looks in the rear view and the dummy's there and he goes, the dummy! And then the car just blows up. It's just the dummy.
I hope all these ideas are on your big whiteboard.
They are. The dummy is. I want to shoot. I at least want to get to the point where no matter what movie I do, I always want to shoot a fake trailer. The way Pixar has a short, like, I want to do a fake trailer for a movie just to have the dummy, just to have those scenes shot, because it can't only play in my head.
No, you need to make these things. You need a vessel to start. I'm telling you, there's a coming attraction show in here somewhere.
Yeah.
There is.
Because I'm sure you have tons of time to go off and shoot trailers.
By the way, here's the problem. Whether I have time or not, they run through my head.
So you might
it's
as well
not
just
like
get
I might as well get it out. It's like once you've exercised it, you can kind of let it go and put it behind you, but until then it always haunts you.
Yeah.
God, what else could we do? Got to make something.
We'll create something.
Yeah.
Something will
come
of this.
I'll take it.
Which is so flippant.
Yeah, they'll wow. take it. But you guys, come on.
Come on.
Take it.
Come on. Why not?
They love it.
And then you can make fun of it.
Nah, I already do that on some. I already do that on Netflix. I don't need to be.
What's Netflix?
It's a monolith of entertainment.
It really is a monolith now. They've really absorbed.
The hub. Have you seen their building on Sunset?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's
like
fancy as shit.
It's like Netflix University.
Yeah, yeah, it's super fucking fancy.
It's crazy.
So the Death Wish comes out March...
March 2nd.
2nd. In theaters.
10 days, I know. Yeah. I'm excited.
And this, so when is this going up, Katie? This is going up Monday. Okay, so this goes up.
So you can buy your tickets now.
Pre-order your tickets.
Pre-order them.
For Death Wish. Go see it in a movie theater.
It's really fun. And it's for sure that communal movie theater screaming, cheering. People, we've had amazing, amazing, very, very visceral reactions. People are going fucking nuts nice. In the screenings we've had. So it's good. It's vintage Bruce. I'm telling you, he brought it. He brought his A game. And it's like that Die Hard. So I really, really worked hard. And we worked. He busted his ass. He was amazing. It's like we really got the Die Hard, you know, that vintage Bruce Willis. It's That's fantastic.
Great. I mean, ultimately, he becomes that, but he doesn't start that.
No, he doesn't start that. He starts as the unbreakable, you know, he's a dad, though. I mean, it's the guy with five daughters. So a guy relating to his daughter being in a coma, it was really, he brings that vulnerability, that everyman sensibility. And, you know, you just want him getting justice and getting revenge. He's amazing. We wanted this to be his next franchise.
Well, congratulations on always making things the way you want to make things. Thanks, and being man. Able to build a career.
And you too. Like, what an incredible career you've had.
It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
But
be proud of it. Take the compliment.
Ah, stop it. That would be like Jennifer Lawrence. Oh, let's not get carried away. It's a funny joke. Like, she's just being funny. Why do they give her shit?
Yeah.
Why do they give everyone shit about everything?
Everything's offensive to everyone.
Everything is every bit of comedy is offensive to someone somewhere in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's every important. Bit. It's important that you don't make something that nothing appeals to everybody.
No. Yeah.
You're going to offend someone. That's just how it goes.
Well,
it goes
I think we're sort of conditioned now because of algorithms to be like, everything has to be exactly for me. And like, no, it doesn't. You could just not watch stuff you don't like.
Yep.
What? No, what? Wow, really disappointed. Yeah. I love the wow, really disappointed.
Wow,
really disappointed. Really thought you were okay. Wow.
SMDH.
SMDH, yeah.
SMDH.
Hashtag SMDH. But as we pull away from the docking station and release people back into their lives, I think I'm going to end this podcast by saying, keep your eye on the donut, not the hole.
Eye on the donut, not the hole.
And buy David Lynch coffee.
Exactly.
Just look at my hair. Coffee is grown in my thick, lustrous hair.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.